Coming up is the news.
Iran's army begins a large-scale drill that involves hundreds of operational drones for combat, surveillance, reconnaissance, and electronic warfare. Iran says its 20% uranium enrichment and other nuclear measures are fully reversible upon full compliance of all parties to the nuclear deal. And the U.S. Capitol mobilizes the National Guard ahead of planned protests by President Trump's supporters in the lead-up to the Congress affirmation of Biden's election victory. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian army has launched a large-scale drill involving different types of domestically made drones. The area of the exercise stretches from Iran's northeastern province of Samnan to the eastern borders. The Ground Force, the Air Defense Force, the Air Force, and the Navy are taking part in the maneuvers. During the two-day drill, the Iranian Army flew hundreds of drones for combat, reconnaissance, and suicide missions, as well as electronic warfare. New unmanned aerial vehicles and related systems are also unveiled and tested. The chairman of Iran's Joint Chief of Staff says such drills show the readiness of the military.
The drone drills of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army, as well as the exercises conducted recently in the Persian Gulf and maneuvers planned for the coming days, all indicate that the Iranian armed forces are fully ready to counter any threats posed against the country's security.
Major General Baghdadi said that Iran does not intend to invade its neighbors. The top commander, however, warned that, quote, fingers are on triggers to respond to any action taken by the enemy against Iran. Iran says it has produced the first batch of 20% enriched uranium in the presence of IAEA inspectors at its Fordo facility. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the measure is a remedial action after years of non-compliance by the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal.
I am announcing today.
It was on May the 8th, 2018, where the U.S. President unilaterally withdrew Washington from the internationally recognized 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Following the pullout, Donald Trump left no stone unturned to implement his so-called policy of maximum pressure on Tehran. In line with his policy, Trump not only reimposed sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the agreement, but also came out with several new crippling measures against the Islamic Republic. In May 2019, Iran notified the remaining signatories to the JCPOA that Tehran would roll back some of its commitments under the deal. It cited failure of the signatories to secure the Islamic Republic's interest, in particular in oil and banking sectors, in the face of Washington's pullout and sanctions. But Britain, Germany, and France, known as E3, failed to take any practical measures, even during the coronavirus pandemic, when U.S. sanctions hampered Iran's efforts to purchase medicines and medical equipment. In the wake of Europe's inaction, the Iranian parliament passed a law last month. It called on the government to produce at least 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually and store it inside the country. In line with the legislation, Iran started the process to enrich uranium to 20% purity at its Fordo nuclear facility on Monday, a move that was confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Agency and carried out under the presence of its inspectors. And hours later, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced that the first batch of 20% uranium was produced. Iran's foreign minister defended the measure, saying it conforms with the JCPOA.
A remedial action conforms fully with paragraph 36 of JCPOA after years of non-compliance by several other JCPOA participants. Our measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by all.
Zarif's assertions was echoed by the former ambassador of Iran to the IAEA, who is currently a senior consultant at the United Nations.
Each member state or each party to NPT could reach to any level that they require for their consumptions that they have. The only obligation is to inform the IAEA to verify their declaration.
Iran has maintained that its steps to reduce its JCPOA commitments are completely and quickly reversible as soon as the U.S. and Europe return to their own commitments under the deal. Now the ball is in the court of Europe and the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to practically show whether they are determined to salvage the deal.
A bomb explosion has reportedly targeted a U.S.-led coalition convoy north of the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Local media cited a security source as saying that the blast ripped through the convoy carrying logistical equipment in Saladin Governorate. The source said the explosion caused no casualties. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Tensions have escalated after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas in January 2020. Iraqi people have time and again called for the expulsion of U.S. troops from the country. Qatar's ruler Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani has headed to Saudi Arabia to attend a Persian Gulf Arab summit. The Qatari ruler's trip follows a Monday announcement by Kuwait. Said that Saudi Arabia will reopen its airspace as well as land and sea border with Qatar after a three-year dispute. Now the Tuesday GCC summit is expected to see formal agreements towards ending that dispute. The standoff saw Saudi Arabia, along with Bahrain, the UAE, and Egypt, sever diplomatic ties with Qatar. Riyadh also imposed a blockade on Doha. They accused Qatar of supporting terrorism. That was strongly dismissed by Qatar. Moving on to other news, the U.S. Capitol has mobilized the National Guard ahead of protests by supporters of President Donald Trump. Protests are planned for Tuesday and for Wednesday. They coincide with the Congress meeting to certify Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. President Trump has repeatedly encouraged this week's protests in Washington, D.C. He's also retweeted a promotion for the rally with a message that he will be there. D.C. police have issued a warning that carrying any sort of firearm is illegal. On Monday, the leader of violent far-right group, the Proud Boys, was arrested and charged with the destruction of property related to a previous pro-Trump rally. U.S. President Donald Trump has repeated his claims that he won the presidential election, including the race in the southern state of Georgia.
There's no way we lost Georgia. There's no way. That was a rigged election. But we're still fighting it, and you'll see what's going to happen. We'll talk about it. You know, I've had two elections. I won both of them. It's amazing. And I actually did much better on the second one.
During a rally in Georgia, Trump said President-elect Joe Biden is not taking the White House. Trump said that he's going to, quote, fight like hell to remain in power. Georgia is a state where the outgoing president pushed officials to find votes for him. Trump's Democratic rival Biden won both electoral and popular votes in the November 3rd election. Congress is due to certify the Electoral College votes this Wednesday before Biden takes office on January 20. But Trump keeps refusing to concede defeat. Meanwhile, the U.S. has endured the deadliest week of the coronavirus pandemic with more than 18,000 deaths as the vaccine rollout hits snags. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, one COVID death was reported in the U.S. every 33 seconds. December was also the deadliest month since the start of the pandemic. Health officials have warned that more people are likely to die in January. So far, more than 353,000 fatalities have been reported out of over 20,780,000 confirmed cases. The country continues to report a steep rise in cases despite the rollout of the COVID vaccines. The governors of New York and Florida have warned they would reduce future allocation to those hospitals that fail to dispense shots quickly enough.
Any provider who does not use the vaccine could be fined up to $100,000. Going forward, they have to use the allocation within 7 days. Otherwise, they can be removed from future distribution.
The U.S. government has distributed over 15.4 million vaccines, but only about a quarter of them have actually been administered. Other countries around the world are also experiencing a slow rollout of COVID vaccines. In Spain, doctors and health experts have expressed disappointment over the slow start of the vaccination. In France, the government has promised to ramp up its vaccination campaign after only a few hundred people received the doses in the first week, prompting accusations of a scandal. Most Asian markets reversed early Tuesday losses, which were triggered by a sharp drop on Wall Street the previous day. Hong Kong Stock Exchange, which was the hardest hit, rebounded into the green zone. It was partially due to an announcement that three state-owned Chinese companies would stay on Wall Street. The trio had been earmarked to be delisted on the market. There were also gains in Shanghai, Sydney, and Seoul, although Tokyo, among others, remained in the red. On Monday, all three main indices on Wall Street fell more than 1%. That happened amid uncertainty over key Senate runoffs in the U.S. state of Georgia and more lockdowns caused by a coronavirus surge. Professor of Economics Steve Keen says the drops in markets in Asia and elsewhere would be short-term as governments pump money into exchanges to keep them afloat.
Financial markets are being held aloft largely by government action. What we call quantitative easing has underwritten the American market dramatically. And of course, it's been tried in Japan, Europe as well. Not yet in many Asian countries, but Australia's talking of doing it. And what it involves is the Federal Reserve using its limitless capacity to create money, to buy bonds off financial institutions, which encourages them to use that cash, which doesn't earn any income, to buy shares instead. And that's why we've had what we call the K-shaped recovery. This is going to continue regardless of who becomes the president of America, whether the rightful person or Donald Trump, as he fantasizes. So I think this is just a short-term disturbance. The markets will continue rising, not because they should, but because they're being pumped up by Federal Reserve and other central bank supports. What we've got is dramatically overvalued markets already. When you look at what's called the Shiller CAPE index, which adjusts with the volatility of the market. The market is more overvalued than in any time in its history apart from 1929 and 2000. Again, as I said, the volume of money that the Federal Reserve is pumping into the markets is so extreme, of the order of $3 trillion during COVID so far, that it overwhelms people taking money off the table as they're doing right now. The Fed will dive right back in and try to rescue the market. The Fed is more concerned about rescuing the parasite, being the financial markets, than it is rescuing the host, which is the real economy.
Let's cross on over to Samnan, which is in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, of course, joins us from there to tell us more about the two-day exercises involving the drones and other equipment. Yusuf, over to you.
Well, Kaveh, the massive exercises kick-started today in the province of Samnan, and the Iranian army used hundreds of its domestically built UAVs. A wide range of drones are used during the drill, from reconnaissance and surveillance drones to combat drones. Bombers and suicide drones are being used in this drill, which is a two-day drill aimed at putting to test the latest drones built by Iran domestically and increasing the preparedness and drawing a map of the strategies Iran has with regards to a possible war scenario using its own domestically built weapons. So Iran has made great strides in its drone sector. Of course, the country stepped into the UAV production arena in less than a decade, and of course, during this period of time, the country has advanced and developed a wide range of drones, from reconnaissance drones to combat drones, like Mohajer drone, Mohajer 6. Actually, this is one of the latest drones that is developed and designed and produced by the Iranian experts. It belongs to the Iranian army. Of course, there are also similar drones which are developed and produced by the Iranian IRGC forces. But the drones that are used in this drill, all of them belong to the Iranian army. If we take a look at the drones produced by the IRGC, we, of course, will be certain that the Islamic Republic is a power, one of the few countries that has the capability to produce drones. Iran has concentrated its focus on building a wide range of drones. An example would be the copies of RQ-170, the American drone, which after Iran captured that drone, in less than a year, it unveiled the Iranian version of that drone, which had an edge over its American peer. The Iranian RQ-170, which is called Shahed-171, has the ability to carry and embed bombs, smart bombs, unlike its RQ-170 version. And Iran produced different sizes of that drone and unveiled it just less than a year after it captured the American drone. And here we are seeing a variety of drones are built domestically by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. I'm sure we'll be in touch with the Yusuf Jalali there talking to us from Semnan. Many thanks. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced a new national COVID-19 lockdown in England to contain a more contagious variant of the coronavirus.
With most of the country already under extreme measures, it's clear that we need to do more together to bring this new variant under control while our vaccines are rolled out. In England, we must therefore go into a national lockdown which is tough enough to contain this variant. That means the government is once again instructing you to stay at home.
Johnson said the surge in cases threatens to overwhelm parts of the health system before a vaccine program reaches a critical mass. The new restrictions include school closures from Tuesday and rules requiring most people to stay at home unless there are essential tasks. Johnson, however, said that there is a possibility to start moving out of a lockdown by mid-February if the outcomes of the restrictions are positive enough. Several other European countries have already implemented similar restrictions amid a surge in cases and deaths. Ireland reported a record number of new COVID-19 cases for the fourth consecutive day. Saeed Burazan, London, describes the new lockdown measure by the British Prime Minister as a shock for Britons.
Well, as for the lockdown itself, it really came as a shock. And it speaks volumes about how this government has been going about dealing with the whole pandemic since its onset. Accusations of dithering and starting everything late have been around since day one from the opposition, from the scientific community over the past year. And it seems that the Johnson government has gotten this one also late in the process as well. Prior to the announcement of the lockdown today, they had said, for example, that schools would reopen at the start of January. And then they came out and said that the primary schools would be closed until January 18th. And today, we heard from the Prime Minister that they were going to remain closed until mid-February. That's if we're lucky and if the vaccination continues as planned, or if you look at, and as you just did, you played a soundbite there, if you listen to the whole thing, it looks like it's an open-ended thing. And this was all in the making. There had been warnings before that the months of January and February, the coldest month of the year, where you get all kinds of other illnesses that need treatment, for example, the seasonal flu, that the NHS would be overwhelmed, the NHS being the National Health Service in this country. And that right now, it's at its capacity, according to the information that we've been getting from the government, as well as other sources.
And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has come under heavy pressure from President Trump to back an unconstitutional scheme to overturn his election defeat in a joint session of Congress, says Igor Derish Ryder in an article published under the heading, Trump Loyalists Sue Mike Pence to Give Him Power to Overturn Election Results. Here's the details. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has come under heavy pressure from President Trump to back an unconstitutional scheme to overturn his election defeat in a joint session of Congress. According to multiple reports, advisors have repeatedly had to explain to the president that the vice president's role is merely ceremonial. Trump has lost every legal challenge after failing to show evidence of fraud or irregularities and is now laser-focused on January 6th, when Pence will preside over a joint session of Congress to formally count the electoral votes. As his last stand for overturning the electoral outcome, multiple administration officials told the New York Times Maggie Haberman. Trump has demanded that Pence act to stop the ratification of the Electoral College, which cast 306 votes for Biden and 232 for Trump earlier this month, according to CNN. Sources told CNN that Trump has been confused about why Pence cannot overturn the results on January 6th, even as Pence and White House aides have tried to explain to him that his role is more of a formality and he cannot unilaterally reject the Electoral College votes. Trump has raged at Pence and top White House officials in recent days as they have pushed back on his doomed scheme and would view Pence carrying out his constitutional duty and validating the election result as the ultimate betrayal, according to Axios' Jonathan Swan. This pressure arguably puts Pence in a bind since legally he cannot do anything to affect the result. The vice president reportedly plans to flee Washington for his first overseas trip since the coronavirus pandemic began right after the session. Pence's constitutional role is to open their certificates. That is it, said Harry Littman, a former Justice Department official and constitutional law expert at UCLA. Not to certify. Not even technically to count. He has no way even to purport to change the count. It would be like saying the Oscar presenters get to decide who wins Best Picture. The idea that Pence is going to overturn the election in January is pure fantasy land nonsense. Justin Levitt, an election law expert at Loyola Marymount University, told Vice News. The 12th Amendment of the Constitution requires each state to submit its Electoral College results to the President of the Senate, who is the Vice President. The Electoral Count Act of 1877, which was passed after several states tried to send rival sets of electoral ballots to be considered by Congress in 1876 election, lays out the rules governing objections to the results. Objections to individual state returns must be made in writing by at least one member each of the Senate and House of Representatives. If an objection meets these requirements, the joint session recesses and the two houses separate and debate the question in their respective chambers for a maximum of 2 hours, according to the Congressional Research Service. The two houses then vote separately to accept or reject the objection. They then reassemble in joint session and announce the results of their respective votes. An objection to a state's electoral vote must be approved by both houses in order for any contested votes to be excluded. The vice president does not have a role to play in the objection process except to preserve order at the session. This authority may be interpreted as encompassing the authority to decide questions of order, but the statute is not explicit on this point, according to CRS. Nothing in either the text of the Constitution or the Electoral Count Act gives the vice president any substantive powers. Legal experts Neil Katyal and John Monsky wrote in New York Times op-ed. Moreover, the law applies to dueling slates of electors approved by state legislatures. Although Republicans staged alternative meetings in states where Trump has disputed the results and appointed what they deemed alternate slates of electors, these have not been authorized by any state legislature or Secretary of State. In other words, they are effectively fake electors. None of this has stopped Trump loyalists from engaging in frantic scenarios. White House advisor Stephen Miller bragged about the phony electors on Fox News earlier this month, claiming that an alternate state of electors in the contested states is going to vote and we are going to send those results up to Congress. Pence and Trump recently met with a group of congressional Republicans to discuss a plan by Representative Mo Brooks, who plans to try to challenge the Electoral College results from at least 6 contested states. Several House Republicans have said they plan to join Brooks in challenging the results in Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Georgia, Wisconsin, and perhaps other states. Brooks would need a senator to join the effort in order to lodge a written challenge. No senator has firmly stated that he or she will join the effort, although senators Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Ron Paul of Kentucky, as well as Senator-elect Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, who will take office on January 3rd, have signaled that they are open to the idea. But even if lawmakers lodge a challenge, federal law only allows for a 2-hour debate on whether to disqualify a state's votes. The lawmakers also plan to give a lengthy series of 5-minute speeches that could delay the vote for several more hours. But in the end, a majority of both chambers of Congress, including the Democratic-led House, would have to vote to disqualify a state's results, and that appears impossible. Democrats have decried the effort, while numerous moderate Republicans have similarly rejected the plan. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has urged Republican senators not to join the effort. Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number 2 Republican in the Senate, predicted that the effort would go down like a shot dog. A similar scenario played out in 2005 when a group of Democrats led by Ohio Representative Stephanie Tubbs-Jones and California Senator Barbara Boxer filed an objection to Ohio's results after alleging numerous serious election irregularities. The challenge was roundly defeated by a 267-231 vote by the House and 47-1 vote in the Senate, effectively just delaying the certification for several hours. The January 6th meeting is going to confirm that regardless of how many objections get filed and who signs on, they're not going to affect the outcome of the process. Edward Foley, a constitutional law expert at Ohio State University, told the New York Times. Republicans evidently realize that their effort violates the law. So a group of Trump loyalists actually filed a lawsuit against Pence recently, arguing that the electoral count unconstitutionally prevents him from exercising full authority over which votes to count, and asking a judge to overthrow the existing rules in order to allow Pence to handpick the president. Legal experts have roundly dismissed the lawsuit. If the 12th Amendment somehow gave the vice president the power to unilaterally throw out electoral votes for the other guy in favor of their own party and even themselves, one might think that one of them would have noticed by now, wrote Steve Veladek, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Bottom line, there is no secret legal maneuver left to stop a Biden presidency. Pence and McConnell understand these rules and are in an awkward political position of their own sad making, tweeted Jed Shagerman, a professor at the Fordham University School of Law. Any drama before or on January 6th will be merely a pathetic show of Trump loyalty or cowardice. Though Trump's legal efforts and attempt to subvert the Electoral College results were doomed to fail from the beginning, his false claims about irregularities have swayed many Republican voters who have contributed more than $170 million to an effort that his team claims funds his election challenges, but largely just flows money into his personal PAC. Representative Adam Kinzinger ripped Trump and his Republican supporters over the weekend, describing the entire effort as a grifting scam. All that is being done is certain members of Congress, the president, and thought leaders on Twitter are getting retweets, getting followers, and raising money on this scam, he told CNN. It is a scam, and it is going to disappoint the people that believe this election was stolen, that think this is an opportunity to change it.
The debate.
It's news that is a bombshell. The sitting U.S. president pressing the secretary of one of the states in the U.S. to look for votes and overturn presidential election results. Such is the case when it comes to U.S. President Donald Trump and the Georgia Secretary of State. Is this enough grounds for an impeachment? The re-elected U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi thinks so. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the Trump antics and his push to reverse the U.S. presidential election in order to stay in power in the name of voter fraud. First, let's go to Chicago and talk to our correspondent, Ramin Mazari, who joins us. Well, Rami, this piece of news has certainly made a lot of noise. Tell us, in a nutshell, what went down.
Well, I think above all, the call shows what a political crisis the United States is still in and how a Biden victory is still not certain. You know, anyone who thought there would be a sort of Christmas miracle and that the recent holiday week had changed things, it's already proven to be wishful thinking on the first day back to work for so many here. It's really quite a start to what will be the most important week in this country since Election Day. This week is really going to be full of chaos, protests, and unpredictable events. Tomorrow, the fate of the Senate will be decided in two runoff races in Georgia, and polls are still too close to call. And then on Wednesday, the president will be decided by the electoral college. This vote will certainly be disputed, but it certainly seems very, very likely that Joe Biden will be elected president on Wednesday. But who really knows? This hour-long phone call, it's been called an insight into Trump's unprincipled, bully, businessman personality. But it's also showing how national-level politics in the U.S. is agreed upon by elites and not by the laws or really the people. You know, beyond the usual Trump psychology angle, the call is a genuine reminder of how very disputed this election is and probably always will be. In the call, Trump claimed Georgia officials have covered up acts of vote fraud, which cost him hundreds of thousands of votes. And polls show that, consistently show that 40% of the country agrees with Trump, and they believe that Biden's victory is illegitimate due to vote fraud. So it's not as if Trump is some sort of outlier making, you know, unheard of accusations. I mean, this is all over the country and has been, you know, ever since November 3rd. You know, nobody really knows who leaked the call, but of course the U.S. military establishment monitors the U.S. worse than the KGB or the Stasi ever could. So many believe it was, you know, leaked by them to the Washington Post. And the U.S. military has been increasingly vocal and open about respecting the current vote totals and that Trump did not win. And that really reminds us of how powerful the U.S. military here is in this country. And they are flexing their muscles. And this may be, you know, just, you know, the latest act. It's also important to remember that this comes in the context of complete economic catastrophe for Main Street, total cultural division, and the still raging corona, you know, pandemic. So we basically had a week off for Christmas and the New Year's holiday, but this call really pulls us back into the maelstrom, which is America in 2020 and now 2021.
Thank you very much for that. Rami Mazari there, a correspondent talking to us from Chicago. Let me bring in author, investigative journalist, and founder of DCReport.org, David K. Johnson, who joins us from Rochester, New York. David K. Johnson, welcome. What has happened exactly? Tell us what this U.S. President Donald Trump has done in this phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, or Perger.
Well, let's begin with Donald Trump lost the election, lost it overwhelmingly. There is zero involvement by the U.S. military in this, and it's offensive that your correspondent just said that. In fact, it's been very clear that the U.S. military has no role in this, and the phone call was pretty clearly leaked by Georgia officials who taped it for their own protection. Now, in this hour-long phone call, people get to see that Donald Trump, I've known for more than almost a third of a century now, he is committing crimes in making this phone call. It is an offense under both Georgia law and United States federal law to seek to change the results of an election through improper conduct. And a number of law professors, former prosecutors, I'm a law lecturer, I'm not a lawyer, have all pointed out that this thing is plenty of grounds here for criminal indictment of Donald Trump by the state of Georgia, by the federal government, and by impeachment, though, given that there's only 2 weeks to go, Donald Trump is not going to be impeached again. Donald Trump is a man who has never been accountable for anything wrong he's done in his life. He spent his entire life as a con man, lying, cheating, stealing, and tricking people. And that many people believe there was election fraud when Republican election officials that control the election process in many states are saying that's nonsense, and they continue to believe it, is an indication of how gullible people can be. That's how con artists operate. They depend on the gullibility of people who wish things to be true, but that aren't. That's what children are.
Okay, let me bring in now a conservative political commentator, and national political correspondent at the Tennessee Star, Neil McCabe, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Neil McCabe, welcome. Let me find out, first of all, your account of what has transpired in this leak, which, well, you heard what David K. Johnston said there, and what many have described, which I will get into, but first, your take on it.
Well, first of all, if this was not actually a formal or official settlement conference, it was, for all intents and purposes, held as a settlement conference. And this is an opportunity where two parties in a dispute can get together and hash things out. Typically, these conferences are off the record. Certainly, they're not admissible in court. And certainly, it's a violation of professional ethics for attorneys, including the attorney who is the Secretary of State of Georgia, to record such a meeting. And certainly, it's beyond any kind of legal ethics to release a tape of an improperly recorded meeting. In this meeting, the president and his team were making a case, a forceful case, for what they see as election irregularities. And in these sort of settings, people speak freely. That is the point. You want both parties in a room speaking freely, with the confidence that everything that they say will be kept in the room. And then when the conference is over, the goal of this sort of meeting is to avoid a lawsuit, to not go to court. This is what happened. The Secretary of State acted in terrible bad faith, since he was the only one in his team. They knew there was a recording, and they knew the recording would be released. And so they were able to sort of temper their interactions with the president and the president's team, and maybe even debate him, knowing that they had this trick up their sleeve.
Well, wait a minute. So you're zooming in on that aspect of it, which I'm guessing you do have a point there. I'm not too familiar with the law, but obviously when you're recording somebody, especially of that stature, you have to inform that person. But the way that this news is being reported, it's being reported as if this is the U.S. president soliciting election fraud by asking the Georgia Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes, and then threatening him if he did not find those votes.
It's ridiculous on it. Any high school student will tell you that the President of the United States has no authority to tell the Secretary of State of Georgia to do anything. He is acting as a
But he was on tape.
He was running for president as a citizen, and he has the right to advocate for his position. He has the right to make his case to the Secretary of State. He has no pressure. The president wasn't threatening to arrest anyone. He didn't say he was sending in the 82nd Airborne. This was a settlement conference that was supposed to be off the record, and he was making his case. The president is aggrieved. He has serious concerns. There are millions of Americans who have the same questions about what happened in Georgia, and he was making that case in what he thought was a private meeting.
Okay. David K. Johnston, go ahead.
Well, your other guest clearly does not know the law or understand the law. There was no violation of any law in recording that call by the Georgia officials. And furthermore, any suggestion of legal privilege was completely vitiated by having Mark Meadows and other parties on the call. But there's no legal matter here that would provide any privilege of any kind. And statements that Donald Trump made on that tape clearly constitute the commission of crimes. Now, whether they'll be charged as crimes or not is an entirely separate matter. We should, your listeners and viewers should, excuse me, wait till I'm done and then you can complain. We have recounted the votes in Georgia several times. Republicans are in charge of the vote counting. A Trump campaign has not established a single case anywhere in the country, certainly none that would be big enough to overturn an election, of any kind of vote fraud. This is pure con man nonsense by Donald. And the caller, clearly he cites high school. I suggest the caller should go to college, take some law courses, and learn what the law actually is, because he's totally misinformed here. And I don't want your viewers to be misinformed. Nothing improper went on here except for Donald Trump's threats. And clearly your other guest does not understand the nature of what a threat is under the law and why it is illegal what Donald Trump did.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, obviously, what I said was it was a violation of ethics. I didn't say it was a violation of law. And that's such a ridiculous dodge to tell me whether something's illegal or not illegal. The Holocaust was legal, sir. The Gestapo was enforcing the law. It doesn't mean that it was correct. I don't think you would tell any of your students that it was ethical to secretly record a meeting that everyone assumed was private, nor to release
the
press.
Sure.
Perfectly you would tell your students to secretly record the President of the United States.
As both a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and as a law lecturer and someone who knows this area of the law deeply, under Georgia law, there was nothing improper, and there's no reason for the Georgia officials not to release that tape. There is no ethical issue here, except in the minds of people who are Trump sycophants.
Well, I'm curious as to why Neil McCabe, again, I'm just curious as to why you're zooming in on this aspect of it in terms of the it being ethical for the Georgia Secretary of State not to have informed Trump instead of what is being reported. You see, you have all this news that's splashed all over the place now regarding the fact that they are saying that, you have the Democrats to say impeachment is in order again. You have a call that's made to the FBI, who declined to look into the matter, but did acknowledge that Trump could face a criminal investigation and has now said that the Fulton County District Attorney should look into it. So you have the way that this is being presented. Now, what I'm asking you is, what can you come out in defense for Trump to say, no,
he didn't do what
they're claiming that was obviously the law to have been broken?
Well, the President of the United States did not threaten to kill anyone or arrest anybody. He didn't threaten to send in the 82nd Airborne. He didn't threaten to abuse his presidential powers. He was making an argument in what he thought was a closed-door private meeting. And so he was advocating his case. Now, it was a political... If he said there would be retribution, or if he said that there would be a price to be paid, obviously he was speaking in a political context about an elected official in Georgia. The President of the United States cannot order the Secretary of State to do anything. He was there very much as a private citizen, and he's aggrieved. And if you were in the situation that the President was in, and you knew that there were thousands of ballots in Georgia counted as mail-in ballots that were never even folded, you would have questions. And so
what did he mean when he told them to go look for the votes? Where was he supposed to go look for the votes?
Well, how about the votes of mail-in ballots where the ballots were never folded and never went into envelopes?
Okay.
That's a place to start. How about those boxes that people put out all over the state of Georgia where people were just dumping mail-in ballots into these boxes that people were just leaving out in the street?
Uh-huh.
There was tremendous
We unfortunately are looking at just a few minutes left to this debate, so I didn't move past the second question, not maybe even the first one. So, Devin K. Johnson, I got to move on to what's happening on Wednesday, the Congress's electoral vote count. Tell us exactly what this is about, and tell us what many are under the impression that this could prevent Biden from being elected, if that's the case.
It will not prevent Biden from assuming office. This is a ministerial act by Congress. There is no substance to this whatsoever. The handful of Republicans who said they are going to oppose this are now being attacked by principled Republicans who believe in the rule of law and have not sold their souls to the Donald Trump cult. This is complete nonsense being done by Donald Trump. And just keep in mind, Donald Trump is the third generation head of a white-collar crime family. He spent his entire life not making money through the competitive market, but extracting money by not paying people, by not paying taxes, by cheating. All of this is thoroughly documented. I have thousands and thousands of pages documenting this stuff. It's in my books about Donald Trump. And nothing is happening except that on the 20th of January at noon, Donald Trump will no longer be president of the United States. Thank God.
Neil McCabe, obviously these are divisions that are existence in the American society. We're looking at both you and our guest there in Rochester who have obviously, to say the least, difference of opinions when it comes to Donald Trump. Where is the U.S. headed after January 20th if Joe Biden, the president-elect, comes into office? What's going to happen?
Well, Joe Biden is going to have a really rough time. We saw that Nancy Pelosi had to fly in somebody suffering from COVID just to make sure that she squeaked by in her election for speaker. If the Republicans at any point in the House flip 6 or 7 moderate Democrats, Nancy Pelosi literally loses control of the lower chamber. We're going to see if the Republicans hold on to the Senate. But even if they don't hold on to the Senate, those are very, very tight margins in both chambers. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden is going to have a very difficult time. And he's not the energetic guy. He's not the actively moving and understanding guy that we even saw 4 years ago. Joe Biden's going to have a very difficult time.
Okay.
Because of his own limitations and the limitations on Capitol Hill.
In a minute, David K. Johnston, we have heard Donald Trump saying that he's going to come back after 4 years. You have, 70-plus Americans who voted for Donald Trump. If you have Trump, who says he's going to come back, have a loudspeaker for the duration of these 4 years, this could really create schisms inside American society. Do you agree?
Yes. I think that Donald is going to spend the next 4 years trying to act as a government in exile. He's going to continue to spread the ridiculous nonsense he's done. And, of course, it's a very low-energy job for him. Remember, he said as a candidate he would never leave the White House and never play golf, played more golf than any president by far in history, disappears for days at a time, because those of us who know Donald personally know that he is a very lazy man. He is not a high-level worker. He's just good at fooling people into thinking that. But we're going to see a continuing effort by anti-democratic forces, people who do not believe in the American Constitution, including, clearly from his remarks, your guest, and who do not understand the law, trying to keep the autocratic nature of Donald Trump around, or to find someone younger and more vigorous. And I think that's a real threat to the liberties of the people of the United States and to the rule of law.
Thank you very much. Let me thank first our correspondent at the top of the debate, Rami Mazari. Also, Neil McCabe, national political correspondent at Tennessee Star. Thank you, Neil. And also author, investigative journalist, and founder of DCReport.org, David K. Johnston from Rochester. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. For me, Kevin Tapway, this is goodbye. Until next time.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the heart and the intellect. Thank you. Although the heart is not the same as the intellect, it is nevertheless where the intellect would ideally reside and govern over our emotions and passions. Then it will be the place for faith, al-iman, mercy, rahmah, and certainty, yaqeen. The reason of this intimate relationship between heart and intellect is the authenticity and directness of heart knowledge compared to mind knowledge. It is dhawq, the taste, or intellectual intuition what is sought for. Other words of heart except for qalb used in Quran are sadr or sudur, the chest, heart, where shaitan tries to gain access. It's been used 25 times in the Quran. Then we have fuad or af'idah, the heart engrossed or inflamed in emotion, happiness, sadness, lust, frustration, anger, or regret. Right? It has been used 16 times in the Quran. Then there's another term that's interchangeably used for heart, and it's called lub, or the plural is albab, the innermost place where the light of tawheed resides. Always used together with the folk of albab, the people of understanding or intellect. And this albab or lub, it has been used 16 times in Quran. So these are some of the words which are sometimes interpreted as interchangeable synonyms of the word heart. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the heart and the intellect, and we describe for you the relationship between the two, and also some interchangeable terms that are used in Quran and prophetic traditions when it comes to heart. Well, first of all, it is absolutely necessary to despise and avoid all sins and to follow the law. Sins are committed and God is forgotten through satanic inspirations, which is also known as waswas. By following the nafs, the ego, that egoistic presence that we have within ourselves, the passions, and because of the love of this world, this worldly life, the dunya, right? So this is absolutely necessary for the cleanliness of heart, the cleanliness of mind, and the cleanliness of soul. Now, this purity is something that is desired in Islam. Instead, it is far better for the servant, the devotee, the abd, to love Allah and His Messenger and tread the straight path, sirat, while being on his guard, and this guard is known as wara. Allah created the qalb as pure. He created it untainted. But every sin, minor or greater, will create a spot or rust on it until when more and more rust settles on this spiritual and physical organ, it will become impure and dim, unable to perceive the divine light. And this is how the heart becomes corrupt. This is how the heart becomes unclean and impure. So let's pray to Allah to keep our heart and our intentions clean and pure. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.